Unlike Andy Namias, who's been working in this field for, I think, 57 years, I've only been working in it for 50 years. I'd like to survey the audience to find out how many else of you have been working 50 years in the field. Nobody's raising their hand. And so that's a long time. But I'll tell you how far we've come in comparing to my first conference. First national conference was the American Society for Microbiology. And there were 10 people in the audience. And four of them were the other speakers. And there were two retired dermatologists and their spouses. I think whatever that adds up to, maybe it's 9 of them. And here we have 1,000. And you can get nervous talking to 1,000 people. But I read in the newspaper, in a cartoon just last week, how to calm yourself when you're talking to a big audience like this. And the secret is to imagine that everyone in the audience is only wearing their underwear. And it supposedly makes you relax. So I'm going to do that, and we'll see how it works. So when I started, it was in 1964 when I was drafted by the Navy and assigned to work on STDs. And there was a textbook I found at that point, and that textbook was about 8 different sexually transmitted infections. And and the one about non-gonococcal urethritis, which was very brief, basically said that it goes away in 6 weeks. And there were some new drugs they mentioned, but they didn't really push them. So that's where things started with that little book for me. And here's what it's like today. And you can see that the number of books and the size of the books has increased as the number of syndromes we deal with and the number of approaches that we have is so much greater. So when I was drafted by the Navy, I was assigned to go to work on this incurable gonorrhea that was being reported from these ships around the Vietnam War in Asia. And when I went out there, I found that 2/3 of the incurable gonorrhea was really not culture positive for gonorrhea, and that never responded to penicillin. And actually, 2/3 was non-gonococcal urethritis. And since the recommendations were you could treat it or not treat it, we did a randomized trial and found out that tetracycline always worked and not treating it never worked. And so that was a nice, simple study, actually. But once we'd finished with men on the ship, we decided to go into the Enterprise would go out for 6 weeks and come back in port. And then the men would be given liberty, would go into a small town called Olongapo, where they would have a lot of beer, often have sex with sex workers, and then come back to the ship. And actually, we studied married men versus single men. The single men had sex 80% of the time with sex workers, and there was a difference. The married men only had sex 79% of the time with sex workers. And so this was the picture of the program. And we were shocked to find out a few things. One was that when the woman, the doctor who worked very hard, took care of the sex workers, she examined, there are 5,000 in town, she examined 250 per day, and she only had one speculum. So the way that worked was she'd have an assistant who'd pick the swab from her. She'd put her speculum into the vagina, get the swab, take it out, swish it in a bucket of water next to her, and then go on to the next woman. 250 times, I figured it might be time to get some new speculums and an autoclave, which we did. And then we worked with the Nightclub and Bar Owners Association. Whoops, let's go back here. Here they are. They agreed to work with us to build a new clinic, pay for the autoclave, and work on improved treatment for the women. The treatment they were giving for gonorrhea was benzathine penicillin, which, as you know, treats syphilis but isn't so good for gonorrhea, and that was why they were selecting so much penicillin-resistant gonorrhea, which was another discovery, and it taught me the importance of going into the field. So today, there are at least 35 known sexually transmitted pathogens and more than 35 STD-related syndromes. And if you think about how that works out, we have the biology and the pathology, the epidemiology, etiology, pathogenicity, pathogenesis, diagnosis, treatment, prevention, and control. You wind up with lots of areas of research, and our groups and many of you around the country and the world have been working on various aspects of this. But as a result of that, there has been a tremendous amount of progress made. And to sort of list that progress, there's been research on defining all these new pathogens, which I'll say a little bit more about, on defining the syndromes. So many new diagnostics, at least over the years, 20 new categories of diagnostics. Now a big focus on home testing and self-testing, rapid testing. Many new treatments have been found, number of new categories of drugs. Vaccines, male circumcision, other preventions, and then other health systems and service changes. For example, expedited partner therapy, online and point-of-care tests, mass communications, and communication technologies, and so on. I'm not going to have time to go into most of these at all, but just to say a little bit about research, there actually have been a few Nobel Prize winners in this field, and the first one was 1927, Julius Wagner Joreg, developed something called malaria therapy, where we could take blood from a patient with vivax malaria, inject it into a patient who had general paresis with syphilis, and that was what he got the Nobel Prize for. So we've gone a long way since then, needless to say. And in 2008, Dr. Barre Sinoussi and Luc Montagnier split the Nobel Prize with Harold Zurhausen, Montagnier and Sinoussi for discovering of HIV as a cause of AIDS, and Harold for discovery of HPV 16 and 18 as cause of cervical cancer. And in addition, Paul Ehrlich got a Nobel Prize for immunology, although he also discovered arsphenamine, first treatment for syphilis. And Alexander Fleming, of course, co-discoverer of penicillin, got the Nobel. And Bob Gallo, although he hasn't gotten a Nobel Prize, he received the Lasker Award for discovering the connection between one of the STDs you may not know much about, HTLV, human T lymphotropic virus, the first RNA virus that's associated with cancers. So there have been a growing number of people who've done some really seminal work in this area. Here are some of the effective therapies. I won't go through them. It's really impressive how this has grown. The latest one is this anti-hepatitis C therapy, which unfortunately costs $86,000 for a course of curative therapy. It'll come down. But what's bad is that there are fewer and fewer companies still doing work on antimicrobials. Fortunately, a number still active in the HIV antiviral area, but not in many other areas. So given the expansion of this field, I recently asked an STD clinician I know, what's new in your STD clinic work? Actually, this was about a month ago, and she said, it's just the same old, same old. Chlamydia, trichomonas, gonorrhea, and syphilis. And I'm looking forward to retiring in 2 years. So I was kind of discouraged to hear that. And is that really all that there is there? Why does she perceive that? And it's a question that I'd like us to ponder. But this is actually, of the 35 STDs that I think are, that we know about, I've listed the ones that I think are some of the major ones. And I won't go through them all, but just going down the bacteria, gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis, chancroid, donovanosis, the two that cause diseases like gonorrhea and chlamydia, M. genitalium and the ureolyticum variant of ureaplasma ureolyticum. Lots of BV-associated bacteria being discovered. And then there are at least five different enteric bacteria associated with the gay bowel syndrome. Then there are the viruses, HIV 1 and 2, HTLV 1 and 2, herpes simplex types 1 and 2, human papillomavirus, over 40 genital types now. Hepatitis A, B, and C are known to be sexually transmitted. EB virus and human herpes virus type 8 separately are transmissible and associated with malignancies. Molluscum contagiosum, then the protozoa that are listed here, and then the two ectoparasites. And beyond these, the microbial etiology of a lot of the common STDs, at least 50% or so, are still undefined, and more research will pick those up. For example, non-gonococcal urethritis, mucopurulent cervicitis, pelvic inflammatory disease, and genital ulcer disease. We really don't know the causes of up to half of those. So a lot of these, however, are really disappearing. This is what's happened to chancroid in the United States, and it's basically gone. And I don't know why we had this epidemic in Canada and the U.S. back there in the mid-'80s, late-'80s, but it's not there anymore. And then with the advent of AIDS, there was the introduction of syndromic management for genital ulcer disease throughout the low-income countries, really pushed hard by WHO and others. And partly as a result of that, H. ducreyi and chancroid virtually disappeared. 50% of patients with HIV initially in Kenya had genital ulcers that were chancroid. And as you can see here, it's disappeared basically in South Africa, and then the same thing in Madras in India. So I'm crossing Haemophilus ducreyi and the cause of donovanosis off of my list of the top STD pathogens. And beyond that, here's one of my favorite papers from this week. You've all heard about the endangered species of pubic lice. Jonathan Zentelman is famous for this, of course. And Janet Wilson is here. Smile, Janet. Raise your hand. But this just was published then. Look at this. As the incidence of hair removal from the pubis has increased in England, and it's almost a straight line correlation graphed differently, the rate of lice has gone way down. And so 90% of people in the UK now are shaving their pubic hair, at least in this one area. How many of you are from the UK here? Would you raise your hand? Nobody raised their hand. So this is pretty amazing. So as a result, I'm not listing this as one of the high profile ones. So only the red ones are the ones I think are really very high priority because of the morbidity they caused. And I initially on my list have not included, because they've disappeared in MSM, the enteric bacteria or the protozoa that were associated with enteric infections in MSM pre-AIDS. And as an anecdote, about the time that was 2 years before HIV, while we were looking at this phenomenon of the gay bowel syndrome, about 50% of the men coming into our STD clinic were MSM who had intestinal symptoms. They either had what we ultimately called proctitis, proctocolitis, or enteritis with 12 different pathogens associated with it. And I went to this meeting shortly after some of our work to present some of these data that Tom Quinn worked up. And the question, you know, since the advent of AIDS, this is gone, this went away. But now, is it going to come back? Because we have the return of lymphogranuloma venereum and a lot of the enteric bacteria and protozoa reported particularly from the UK. And so I'm keeping the enteric bacteria and the Giardia and E. histolytica on my list of top diseases. When I went to give this talk in Chicago, as David Ostro summarized, at the end, I just didn't think we had the tools to cope with this anymore in 1979. And my talk was that it had to be behavioral and sociological factors that we would change to stop this epidemic of increasingly and new diseases in MSM. This was pre-HIV. And then, you know, a year later, we have HIV. And when HIV appeared and spread, and we scaled up syndromic management of STDs in low-income countries, we did see the dramatic decline of early syphilis and other STDs, first among MSM in the high-income areas and then in the general population of all countries. And just to illustrate this, here you can see for gonorrhea in the U.S., this is a little pale, but you can see that about 79, 80, it began to really drop. And it continued to drop and then stabilized until today. So that's what's happened to gonorrhea in the AIDS era. It's good to look at particular areas that, where they have the data all consolidated. This is from King County. Laura Williams and I submitted this to a journal because we entitled it The Elimination of Primary and Secondary Syphilis in King County, which began to be seen in 1990. And they sent it back to us, wanted some changes, didn't accept it. And so it was in 1996 in Vancouver that HART was announced, and that shortly after that we had the Global Fund and PEPFAR were funded to scale up work that included STDs initially in low-income countries. And so what happened after Vancouver and after the availability of combination ART was that we have seen this enormous resurgence of syphilis and gonorrhea and MSM and in a subset of low-income minority populations in the States. And although HIV rates dropped considerably, they've leveled off, and there's a disastrous continuing 50,000 roughly new HIV infections every year in these populations in the U.S. And even more alarming in some ways is the resurgence of lymphogranuloma venereum proctitis and other intestinal infections in MSM. This has been best documented in the UK. Recently, there were a number of papers about this. And I don't know why it's not well documented in the States, except I think it's that we're not systematically looking like we used to. And here's what happened in Seattle. We called it we saw this amazing return that starts here, and I'll give you a little bit more in a minute. So we resubmitted the paper, and we called it The Elimination and Reintroduction of Primary and Secondary Syphilis, which the American Journal of Public Health took. Well, this is what's happened now. This goes up to 2012, and it shows the reintroduction of early syphilis into King County. Now, this is what we call an epidemic. We have an epidemic of syphilis in MSM, and it's not just in the King County area, but here's what we're documenting. And you can see the red is MSM, and the blue is in heterosexual population. And this separates the HIV-negative MSM from the estimated number of HIV-positive MSM. And you can see that the epidemic among MSM is largely concentrated to the HIV-positive MSM. So this is really an epidemic of syphilis that's occurring in HIV-positive MSM in our neighborhood, and I think in many parts of the country. We don't have complete reporting on sexual orientation from the whole country, which is one of the challenges. This shows the data from the gonorrhea isolate surveillance study showing the percentage of urethral GC isolates from MSM through the STD clinics. This is just testing urethral specimens, so it isn't even picking up the pharyngeal and anal specimens that represent about half of all the gonorrhea and the MSM. But what it shows you is this huge increase that's continuing. And these, again, are the data just from Seattle, and it shows you this epidemic, again, of gonorrhea, that is occurring among MSM. And you can see gonorrhea is really controlled in the heterosexual population where we are, and this is not dissimilar from many areas of the country. So the sexual behavior trends that we're seeing in high-income countries is that we're seeing more and more serosorting and seropositioning in MSM, and unprotected anal intercourse is increasing as a result. And this is actually leading to more densely connected sexual networks. I don't know if David Katz is here, but one of our ideas is that when you have seropositive men mixing with seropositives and seronegatives with seronegatives, you're creating denser connected sexual networks. And our hypothesis is that this very high incidence in unusually dense sexual networks is partly related to serosorting. Serosorting, in my opinion, is unsafe for HIV prevention, particularly when there is infrequent HIV testing, inconsistent asking of partners about their serostatus, particularly about the timing of their last serologic study, And whatever it does for HIV, it's clearly increasing the risk of other STDs. So it's a double whammy. Now, those are data from the U.S. What's happening globally? And here is actually what's been happening. A steady decline in the number of cases of HIV that are being seen globally. There's the incidence of HIV. And this began long before Global Fund and PEPFAR got drugs out to these countries. We estimate that it was really in 2005, 2006 that we began to see scaling up of antiretroviral therapy with these programs. And yet you'll see that the incidence of new HIV cases was dropping beginning in 2000, 2001. It wasn't due to implementing combination ART. It was changing behaviors, and it was, I think, perhaps attributable to the syndromic management of STDs that was going on aggressively with dramatic effects on STDs as risk factors. So a little more on STD surveillance highlights. This is what's been happening to chlamydia, and you can see with changes in testing and increased testing, there's been a steady increase, actually, in the number of positives for chlamydia in men and women in total. But in terms of pelvic inflammatory disease, we have seen a steady decline, and I would say in terms of severe pelvic inflammatory disease, a dramatic decline. Our OBGYN residents now are lucky if they see one or two cases of PID that's hospitalized per year, and they used to have them in the hospital all the time. So this has been a dramatic change. And I'd like to say a bit about the era of viral STDs, not only HIV, which I won't dwell on, but other major viral STDs. So this is the data from our CDC surveillance for genital herpes showing a steady increase in initial visits to physicians' offices up to 2012, which how much of that is due to just increased healthcare seeking because people are more aware and now there are drugs for it, or a real increase is an interesting question. And here are data from CDC, Fujizu, and this is a little hard to read, but if you sort of pull out the data and blow it up, you can see that for the non-Hispanic whites up here, that in the 14 and 19-year-old age group and the 20 to 29-year-old age group, there has been a drop from 1999 to 2004 and in 05, 08, that's pretty dramatic. And the same is seen for 14 to 19-year-olds in the non-Hispanic blacks. So it does look like the number of new cases. Here's a study in Haines where you're actually doing random serological testing in the United States. So surveys give you data that's different from the surveillance gives you data different from the surveys. And here's genital warts, and you can see that the number of genital warts is continuing to go up through 2012. And here's something that I really like is from UW students. And you can see that among female UW students who come in who hadn't had sex, who continue to be followed, that they not only graduate with a diploma, but they have a 50% plus chance of getting HPV by the time they graduate. This is an extremely common infection among young adults, and that has continued to be the case. So HIV incidence, as I said, I won't say much about it, but you can see that the peak incidence fell in the mid-1980s. The peak incidence, I should say, was 130,000 per year, and then it rapidly fell, but it's remained stable at 50,000 roughly per year, new cases, for many years, despite the availability of ART, which I think is a disaster. And the total number since 1981 is over 1.8 million in this country. 650,000 deaths, but that has greatly decreased, and the number living with HIV is estimated to be 1.1 million. This is what's happened to acute hepatitis B, and Jonathan Ward sent me this a few years ago. This is not just attributable to the hepatitis B vaccine, undoubtedly contributing, but I think that like some of the other diseases with the fear of HIV, sexual behavior changed, and that's partly responsible for that decline. So there have been a number of really good national surveys to complement the CDC's surveillance system. And they include the NHANES study, which has had multiple surveys and is ongoing. The USA Ad Health study, I don't think that's still going on, but studied adolescents in representative samples of high schools. Then there's the Peru Prevent study. Cesar Carcamo and Patty Garcia are here. Cesar led this. I'll show you a slide from it. China is beginning to do some interesting surveys. The UK NATSOL studies, the third generation, really are getting to be quite strong. Here are two that were published in 2013. The first one showed the rates of various STDs, the prevalences in their random sample. And the second one studied sexual function in Britain, and it showed, not surprisingly, that poor health was associated with decreased sexual activity or satisfaction, but the really sad part of that study was that sex decreased greatly with age over 45 in men and over 35 in women. Anybody here from the UK? Raise your hands. So, and then there have been two interesting systematic reviews. The WHO estimates of prevalence and incidence of the four major curable STIs in 2008 was published, and it showed that there were an estimated 50 million of the four most common curable ones. But the remarkable study that was recently published from CDC showed that there were 19.7 million cases of STIs, and these cost $15.6 billion, which is quite a remarkable figure, and that was an important study, I think, to be done. And I'm looking for the name of the author of that so I can acknowledge him, if I can find it. Dr. Owusu Edusi, I think, or Edusi, did that study. So, and these are the data from the Peru study that were carried out by Cesar Carcamo. And the nice thing about this study, just to illustrate how useful this can be, is that they looked at six different sexually transmitted infections, and then they divided the sample up into men who had no sexual intercourse, up through men who had sex with other men or sex workers. And then women were categorized with good questionings using self-administered questionnaires for sexual experience and having sex for money, and then sex workers as well. These are really nice data that give you a sense of what's going on, at least in a household sample. So I think, summarizing all this, that there have been five eras of rapidly changing sexual risk, from 1914 through 2014. First was the World Wars I and then II, and then the Southeast Asia War, which drove STI rates up, and then they dropped a bit after each of these ended. In the 1960s, there was the introduction of hormonal contraception and then of IUDs, and the fear of pregnancy was greatly abated. The gay liberation movement, Stonewall, occurred. And the baby boom generation from World War II came of sexual maturity age. Then in the late 1980s and early 90s, we had the onset of the HIV epidemic and a rapid decrease across gay and heterosexual populations in STIs. And then in 1996, it reversed, and with the introduction of combination ART, there was rapidly an increase in syphilis, gonorrhea, and other STIs, and a striking concentration now of STIs in MSM, especially in HIV-positive MSM, where I think serosorting is playing a major role. And then in 2014, we have the introduction of PrEP, and we don't know what the impact of that will be or how widely it will be scaled up or in what population, so it's a question mark. This shows you when the oral contraceptives were scaled up, and it shows beginning in 1964, although it was first introduced in 60, and then how it's continued since then, that undoubtedly had a big impact on STD rates, if you plot that against the maps I showed you. This was just published by Don McNeil in the New York Times a little over a week ago, and he made an analogy between the introduction of PrEP and what happened with the introduction of oral contraception, and that is food for thought. Ken Mayer gave a great talk on PrEP earlier in the meeting. So coming up to summarize a bit, I think for all of you, your 10 biggest accomplishments recently have been this huge decrease in HIV mortality globally, but unfortunately with the HIV incidence staying at 50,000 per year, which is horrible. The GC and syphilis incidence has been controlled. Chancroid and the disseminated gonococcal infection has just about disappeared, except in MSM. We now have treatment for herpes, hepatitis B virus, and human papillomavirus incidents are declining. The cervical, vulvar, oropharyngeal, anal, and penile cancers are all being prevented by HPV vaccines, although we really only have good data for cervix. There are about as many oropharyngeal about to be as there are for cervix. Liver cancer and cirrhosis are being prevented by the HB vaccine. So these two vaccines are two of the most important things you can be doing in your sexual health clinics. Condoms are shown to prevent now in good studies HIV, herpes, human papillomavirus infection, Rachel Weiner study in particular, hepatitis B virus, chlamydia, and gonorrhea. I didn't have time to present data on condom social marketing. It's under review now. But it shows that in a community randomized trial of condom social marketing, it significantly reduced unprotected sex. It's very cheap, so do it. We've stopped it. We use the term condom fatigue. It's tragic. We're not still pushing it. Early ART lowers mortality, and ART and PrEP lower transmission. And there are hundreds of thousands of people, healthcare workers, who are being trained globally for HIV care now, but hardly anybody being trained for STI care now. That's a real problem. Specific impact that your work has had on women's and children's health is that STIs are now better managed, less common. Complications are pretty rare. Cervical cancer is potentially 70% prevented by the current HPV vaccines against HPV type 16 and 18. And the Merck's 9-valent vaccine will cover 92% of cervical cancers. We don't know yet, but probably similarly for those other four cancers. There's been a major reduction in postnatal HIV transmission, both through PMTCT as well as through changes in breastfeeding practices in low-income countries. Here we just recommend no breastfeeding. Severe PID is a disappearing disease. Ectopic pregnancy and tubal pregnancy are becoming less and less common. Vaginal infection, we have better diagnosis and treatment. BV and trichomoniasis are becoming less common, particularly in higher-income, middle-income people. Perinatal morbidity has been getting better, but it's still not satisfactory. And we're no longer spreading STIs with vaginal specula, which I'm happy to say, as far as I know. The impact on men's health is that we have effective treatment for urethritis. Epididymitis has become a rare disease. Like severe PID. Intestinal infections and MSM are understood, better managed, temporarily controlled, but now returning, which is alarming, alarming, alarming. Anal and penile cancers, again, 70% preventable probably by current HPV vaccines. And now Joel Pilevsky has a funding for a clinical trial for preventing anal cancer, I'm happy to say. So some recent or potential innovations for better control that we should all be alert to and jumping on are the 9-valent vaccine will prevent even more cancers of these five sites. We now have rapid diagnostic testing for syphilis, which can be integrated with HIV, PMTCT, B-plus programs and should be routine for both of them. We are addressing the HIV and STI care and prevention cascades. The options approach for early ART or PrEP, what that means is if you have a serodiscordant couple and the HIV positive member is not yet ready or feeling ready for HIV therapy for ART, then giving PrEP to the seronegative member until that person, the HIV positive, is prepared to start ART is an interesting strategy currently being evaluated in Africa. And I like that approach. It's not very controversial. And then population-level combination interventions for prevention and control of STIs, like the Peru Prevent Study published in The Lancet in late 2012, really is where we should be going in terms of population control. So this is the science of combination interventions or complex interventions, and it doesn't really have to be that complicated. So our remaining challenges, obviously for HIV we need a vaccine and we need a cure, and NIH is putting more money into that. For gonorrhea, we're worried about increasing antimicrobial resistance, although for the moment it's stabilized and even dropped for the cephalosporins. For chlamydia, complications have decreased, but prevalence remains high. For many STIs, in MSM, there is an epidemic of many STIs, and it's unabated, and it's still concentrated in some selected impoverished minority populations. A big concern for all of us here is that public health STD programs are being dismantled in the U.S. and in the U.K. They're threatened seriously. And I think we need to do something about those things. And I think that it's basically the case that global PEPFAR funding, I don't know about global fund money, but certainly for PEPFAR, it's peanuts for STD control. Even though the STD control programs may have been the most effective early interventions for reducing HIV transmission, I believe that, and it certainly wasn't combination ART. No doubt changing in behavior had a role too. So remaining challenges are that half the common syndromes are still idiopathic. We still have 350,000 complications per year of syphilis in pregnancy globally. We need other vaccines, not just for HIV, but herpes, GC, chlamydia, and syphilis. We need to find more effective treatments for curing herpes and ideally for M. genitalium. And I caution you to take a look at this these ideas about strengthening our STD programs, updating them, and getting our case for funding better. We need to have an essential HIV diagnosis program in highest risk persons, and those are the ones coming into these STD clinics because of the combination of HIV and STDs. And the STDs need to do partner testing, which is one of the ways they're reaching out to get more and more of those not tested in. There needs to be effective referral, which the STD clinics can do, outreach for retention, and all of this to move the population level viral load from a horrible viral load suppression from a horrible 35% in our country to why not 95% or 100%, but certainly much higher than 35%. And you can all do that, but most of you are not really doing it. Many are, however. We should have PrEP and individual and population level risk reduction with community-based population research and our participatory research, and this is what STD clinics can do as well. STD clinics can do a lot more, and the CDC involved in big data use for innovative surveillance, and there's a nice session scheduled for tomorrow morning on how that might work, and I want to congratulate the people who did the cost analysis. With this $15.6 billion cost is a huge argument for why we need to keep growing our programs and not shrinking them. So, and we don't just discover these tools, we need to use them. And the British did this interesting study, the Higher Education Council, that found the average time from medical discovery or innovation until impact is actually 15 years in the UK. And I don't know how long it is here, but I don't think it's any quicker. I've even heard 17 years. And for lower and middle-income countries, it's likely higher. Like, we're pretty quick on rolling out combination ART here in the States, but it took 10 years longer in the low-income countries, for example. So we can speed that up in a few ways. My ideas are to conduct more and more of the clinical trials in low-income countries. There's a very little increase in the States or Europe by 3% since we had to start registering clinical trials. We can monitor this for the last 13 years or so. There's about a 10% increase in Latin America, but there's a 460% increase in clinical trials being done in Asia, particularly in China. We need to do more coordinated planning and monitoring from discovery to delivery, and advocacy, which has really been effective for HIV, but not as much for STDs. So as new tools and strategy develop, a lot of things can happen, and here are some examples. The advances can be quickly implemented, like a combination ART in the States, in England. Advances can be eventually implemented, like CART in low-income countries. But we have to confront the fact that something else is that when sexual behaviors become safer, when risk is high, the sexual behaviors do become safer when risk is high, and riskier when new approaches mitigate the consequences of risky sex. We have to figure out how to deal with that. That's a real paradox, and we haven't confronted it. The cuts, we have to deal with the fact that cuts in funding resources are occurring, that these are the resources that enable the successful research and prevention and clinical services that I've been talking about. And lastly, we have to accept that innovation and new approaches and successes can and should contain cost, and we have to build that into the work we do. So 10 priorities, and I'm wrapping it up here, are that these are for cost-effective approaches with community-level implementation. We should focus on key populations, emphasizing program science. The meeting that was held just before this one was really terrific. We have to view safer sexual behavior as one component of essential human rights and sexual freedom for all cultures and ethnicities. HPV vaccine for females and males, we should be shifting. We should continue with the 4-valent as long as what we have, but as soon as the 9-valent comes out with higher coverage, we should be shifting to that as quick as we can. We still need to catch up more in young adults for hepatitis B vaccine. Voluntary male medical circumcision, obviously. Combination ART, I think, more and more upon diagnosis to prevent both disease and transmission. Syphilis, we have to link rapid testing for syphilis and HIV. That should be 100% of the time we test for one, we test for the other, particularly in pregnancy settings. We should continue syndromic management of genital ulcers and urethritis in low-income countries. I think they're having a huge impact that's positive. We should start condom social marketing. And I didn't have time to go into this, but when that's coupled with mass communication campaigns on recognition of STD syndromes, the frequency of STD, and where to go for treatment, that is sort of a one enhances the other. And then expedite a partner therapy for gonorrhea and chlamydia, I think is one of the ways we'll get out to people and bring in people at risk. And unfortunately, I think we also have to be prepared for what's coming down the pike. And that is going to be outbreaks of hepatitis A, hepatitis C, lymphogranuloma variant. I have hepatitis C virus listed twice, and enteric infections among MSM. It's already happening in UK where they're looking carefully, and it's probably happening here. And I think as this continues to happen, we are again at risk for new STIs, a new HIV, or new variants of HIV. Could again follow the epidemics of HIV and of syphilis and of gonorrhea and the reappearance of LGV and these other enteric infections among MSM. I feel now like I felt when I gave that lecture before the MSM physicians in Chicago back in 1979 in terms of what we're saying today. It's not status quo. We've got to do something more. So in conclusion, at first I thought we just needed more and better diagnostics and treatment when I came back from working in the Navy to Seattle. And later I felt that in Chicago that safer sex and changing sexual behaviors was critical. And still later that we needed vaccines, and I know many of you think we need vaccines, but we need more than that. We need program science for efficient and cost-effective and integrated combination of interventions. And we have to have, as part of that, ongoing needs assessments, enabling policies and structural changes at the local and the national level, and innovative integration of clinical and public health systems. So I'm going to conclude now by saying, I will tell you a parable. I have to go home tomorrow morning early, alas. I will miss a lot of this because my global health current class is graduating on Wednesday. But I'm going to tell them this parable. And it's about this wise old woman who lived in a village, and she was so widely respected for her wisdom that people from villages all around came to see her and get her advice and her wisdom. But once three young boys from her village thought that they would trick her and see if they could sort of decrease her status and increase their status. So they had the idea, and they captured a bird, and they one of them put it in his hands. And they went to see her, and they said, wise old woman, we have a bird here. We want you to tell us if that bird is alive or dead. And so their plan was that if she said the bird is dead, they would release it, and it would fly away. And if she said the bird is alive, they would squash it and kill it. And either way, they would make her look foolish. But she looked at them with compassion and with hope. And she said, boys, the future of that bird lies in your hands. And I think for all of you, the future of our field lies in your hands. And so with that note, I want to thank you all for what you've accomplished and will accomplish. Thank you.
So we're getting close to a birthday party, and King, thanks you so much. I have to say that I've loved the journey in STDs because it is so unpredictable, and it is a learning journey, and I know we've got a lot of challenges ahead of us, and we're looking for the younger generation to be smarter and figure all this out. So now I'd like to welcome Lynn Barclay up to the stage. In her real role, which is the executive director for the American Sexual Health Association, she's been an incredible leader in the field of sexual health. She's moved the organization to change their name. That was not without much discussion and challenges. And we're very excited to be able to honor this association that has a long history in the United States with some very interesting origins and evolution to recognize the work that's been done for its 100th birthday party. So she has a little video to share, and then she'll explain what we're doing afterwards. I will say the other advantage of having collaborative conferences, you're allowed to have diverse content presented. So we're very happy to watch Ash's video.
Thank you, Gail. Welcome. All right, so King, you did a beautiful job really setting up the background for STIs. But right now, I know I'm between you and the party. Okay, so I will be quick, I promise. But I really wanted to talk about the fact that I'm the 10th president of ASHA. Because we're 100, so 10. Isn't that interesting? And we like to talk about the fact that when you're 100, we paraphrase Betty Davis when we say, old age ain't no place for sissies. In 1914, people like John D. Rockefeller and Katharine Hepburn's parents were on the front end of a social change movement that created what was originally called the American Social Hygiene Association. At the party you're going to next, you're going to see lots of material paying homage. We brought it in from the archives that are at the University of Minnesota. But for tonight, what we want to do is we want to celebrate. It's really easy in our field to lament what we haven't done yet, the problems we still have to face. But I was reminded not too long ago how much we've actually accomplished. So I'm going to give you my top five. And I want to hear yours, and you'll have your chance at the party to give us yours. Number one, 100 years ago, it was unheard of to talk about STIs. And look at us. We will be talking about and learning about, and then we're going to go out and talk about and teach what we know about STIs. Number two, we have condoms, we have long-acting reversible contraceptives, and lots of other tools that put the question of when and if we have children in our control. Another very important thing for me. Number three, from our homes to our schools, we do a much better job talking to our kids about sex and even our parents about sex. Years ago, and I can't remember what year it is, the ASHA Sex Ed Manual on the cover featured baby bunnies. We're a little past baby bunnies. From penicillin to HPV vaccines, which King clearly talked about, we have far better tools to prevent STIs and even cancer, or some cancers. And lastly, and maybe one of my personal favorites, one state at a time, we're tackling the fact that you can now marry whoever you want. I didn't do it, but I love it. Think about this. When ASHA was founded, in many states, it was illegal to have interracial marriage. So what I want you to do now is look around the room, all of you, people who couldn't come to this conference, people who came before us, have brought us this far. So tonight we are here to celebrate, not lament. Okay? We have come a long way, baby. So when you're celebrating your 100th anniversary, plastic surgery, hair color, it all works. One of the things you do is you say, okay, what are we going to do to celebrate? Well, one of the things that we did was we said, let's do a video.